welcome to Talking Story. I am your host, Lynn Hadley, and for the next half hour, we will be talking story with Bruce and Eileen Williams, who are both retired teachers living in Nacelle at the moment, but have lived in parts of the world near and far while teaching and raising their two children. Welcome, Bruce and Eileen.
Hi, Lynn. It's wonderful to be here.
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for having us.
Happy to have you here. And let's see. Where shall we begin? I'll start with the quote that Bruce just gave me. Wherever we went, it was cool. That sounds like that was a pretty good journey. And this is a journey that started in 1988, you said?
Yeah. We actually started by spinning the globe and dropping our finger on it and landed on Indonesia, and we said, hey, that looks pretty cool. Why don't we go there?
Wow.
And truly, that's how it started. Well, or maybe a little before that.
International school teaching is actually a pretty well-kept secret. It is well-organized. There are private international schools all over the world that offer an American curriculum. And you can apply to them, and if you're lucky and you get hired, you get to go teach at an American school in a foreign country and live. And, well, we thought we'd be living like natives.
We thought we were going to walk into a middle class household, living, you know, middle class at the level of the country we were going to be living in, which in this case was Indonesia. So we thought we were going to be living fairly, you know, rough compared to our fairly luxurious American lifestyle. But when we got there, we walked into this gorgeous three-bedroom house that was fully furnished with and stocked, the refrigerator stocked with American types of food and juice for my daughter, who'd been telling her, no apples in Indonesia, you won't get any apple juice. And there was apples on the table and juice in the fridge.
And rattan furniture and marble floors and smiling household staff waiting to meet us.
Oh, did that take a bit of adjustment?
It was really scary.
You know, Eileen, you were saying something earlier about kind of the overview of, I don't know, different ways of seeing international living and overseas teaching life. That was pretty good to get this organized. Could you say it again? You know, you were talking about the aspects, different aspects of our life overseas. Some of it was, you know, that lifestyle thing. My gosh, that house was so different. And others were the exotic locations that we wound up living in. That's where the quote comes from, because, you know, we could go any direction and find something that was definitely cool. Near and far, 5 minutes from our house or 500 miles from our house, it didn't matter. In between also, it was just that everything was exciting and different and new. Anyway, you know, and then there's that aspect of life where you're, you know, we're teachers and living our lifestyle with our family. You know, these all blend together, of course. But it was quite an experience.
And you were saying earlier, and our audience wasn't here, so that's not fair of me to say. It took some not only adjusting to having household staff, but that it provided such great advantages to your teaching because you were able to focus so much on the task at hand.
That is true. That is really true. We lived at the school most of the time. Our kids went to school there for free as part of our package. We both taught there. If there was an event, it was everybody's event. If there was a holiday, it was everybody's holiday. So we were able to throw ourselves into extracurricular duties like never before because we didn't have to go home and worry about our houses and our babysitting and things like that.
We had people at home to have dinner ready for us at whatever time we said we'd be home. And wow. That's amazing.
Yes, that must be very nice.
We would walk into a spotless house through gardens that were immaculate, and we had somebody to take care of all of that. Oh, my goodness.
So needless to say, if you come to our home in Nacelle today, it will not be spotless. And you will see the definite lack of a gardener in the gardens. We got spoiled. But we should also talk about some of the really cool things that we got to see in Indonesia.
Oh, I'd definitely like to hear that. And there are other places to talk about as well.
Yeah. One of the things about Indonesia is that it has, Bruce, how many islands does the archipelago
have? More than 13,000.
Wow. Right. And a lot of them are developed enough to go visit. So we were fortunate enough to make regular trips from where we lived on the island of Java to our nearby neighbor, Bali. Bali was at that time... Well, everyone always says that with each passing year, places are no longer the same as they were before.
Yeah, everybody would say, oh, you should have seen Bali 10 years ago. And guess what? When we were and had been around for a while, we told people going to Bali for the first time, oh, it's still nice, but you should have seen it when we first got here.
So I can't speak for Bali today, but it was one of the most magical places, I think, that we've ever been, with the terraced rice fields and the beautiful bamboo bells playing in the distance, and the amount of art and creativity on that island
and
is beyond belief.
And don't forget the people, charming, peaceful, loving people that had devoted their lifestyle to producing art and crafts. That was one of their main things to sell. And it went from sort of rough, crafty stuff to absolutely stunning fine art, and every village had their different specialty. It was exciting just to go traveling from village to village, and like I said, the people were just amazing.
Mm-hmm. Were there any artistry or crafts that you had never seen on any place but Bali?
Well, the one thing that we brought home that still blows my mind is a small painting done totally with sharpened bamboo sticks. And if I had the painting here, you would be blown away, because it is incredibly detailed scene of rice farmers in their fields with all the different kinds of flowers, plants, people. And it's almost like you need a magnifying glass to see the detail. And it wasn't done with a brush. It was done with paint and sharpened bamboo.
Wow.
But there is also another thing that Indonesia is famous for, and it's batik. It's dyeing cloth, but having using wax to form a resist so that you only dye certain sections of the cloth. And it's a multi-step process. And it was, so you would basically paint on the wax and then dye the cloth, then take it out and remove the wax, and then where the wax was, dye that with some other color, then paint everything you don't want dyed with wax, and then you dye it in, clean it all up, and you do the next color, and back and forth until you finally get this astonishingly gorgeous piece of art. And they do everything from what looks like tie-dye exciting stuff to scenes that are recognizable and beautiful.
In great detail, that sounds like.
Astonishing detail, yes.
Well, the textiles in general are quite beautiful from that part of the world. Did you have tailors making clothing for you or anything like that?
Not so much in Indonesia, but in the next country we went to, I think it became my hobby having custom-made clothes done.
Ooh, well, what woman wouldn't love that opportunity?
Well, but it wasn't just something that you might like to do. It was something you had to do because there were no ready-made clothes available. This next country we went to was Burma, also now called Myanmar. Or let's see, how would it be pronounced?
Myanmar.
Myanmar. Anyway, and it was quite a place to go because it had been a military dictator. Well, it is now a military dictatorship. It had been a colony of England up until 1963, when General Aung San led a revolution and threw out the British. And he was so angry at the British, they wanted to revert to absolutely everything traditional Burmese style, from clothing to architecture to the cars, and everything. They wanted to get rid of the British. And so the government insisted that everybody do this and become, in a traditional style.
Kind of like a traditional reset button.
Exactly. And so no cars were allowed to be imported after 1963. All cars got repaired. It's sort of like with Cuba, where, those cars had to be incredibly maintained, and motorcycles too. It was a very different sort of a world to step into.
People wore their traditional, they called it the longi, it's like a sarong, both men and women, and their flip-flop sandals, and different kinds of tailor-made shirts and tops, and flowers behind their ears, and that was that. And because the military was so repressive, there was virtually no crime.
Against foreigners, against each other within the Burmese communities, crime was like it is probably in a lot of places. But we as expatriates and sort of special because we're Americans. Oh, one of the things that was interesting in Burma, we couldn't have a school there that was a foreign school. Only Burmese schools were allowed unless they were part of an embassy. So our school was an extension of our embassy, and we were not teachers. We were educational attachés, which came with official passports and official titles, and we got to go in the diplomat line in the airports. It was very cool.
Yes, we had a lot of perks because we were education attachés.
It was a strange thing. We suddenly got a look at the, at least with the upper 10%, if not the 1%, at how they live.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of a trip.
We still flew economy everywhere we went, don't worry. I'm not sure we qualify for the upper 10%.
Well, but in some of those ways, having staff and getting to see these exotic places, it was really special. But just back to something Eileen was saying about our teaching overseas, it was really amazing to have your full time dedicated to creating good education for your students, because not only did we have staff at home to keep covered all the chores there, but our schools gave us one of the schools gave us 2 prep periods each and every day.
What a luxury.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, teachers here just, got a half an hour a day, or some get an hour. We had 2 at most of the schools, 1.5 at some of them. And so we were able to really be creative and comprehensive, I guess. And we didn't have on our backs this worry about the testing and achievement. And we didn't have principles that were dedicated to you have to use this reading series, and if you could say here's a reading series if you'd like, or if you know how to do it another way, go ahead. It just allowed us to expand and be creative, and I don't know, I thought
it's like free range education,
and it was amazing.
But the standards were incredibly high. When I first got to Burma, I was there teaching 7th grade English and K-8 music. K-12 music, I guess, in Burma. Sorry. And in my English class, there were only 9 students. And of the 9 students, 5 of them were sons and daughters of ambassadors. So when I first arrived at Burma, I had a 7th grade English class with about a dozen students in it. Of the dozen, 5 were sons and daughters of ambassadors to Burma. One was the daughter of the superintendent of the school. So while we had free rein, we had really high expectations. They were comparing us to very good teachers and very fine private schools that their students, their kids had attended. So we worked very hard.
And we were in Asia, which Asian education demands are significantly higher than they are in the United States. It's just, you know, it's a something I guess
a
is
given.
Just a truth, a given. And when we first arrived in Indonesia, I was shocked at how much I had to up my standards from, I already had high standards. People in the United States were saying, oh, you shouldn't demand so much of your classes. When I got to Indonesia, I was the one who was behind. My kids were all a grade level ahead of where I was really trying to take them, at least a half a grade. And on the ambassador thing, my first class, I had an ambassador in my class, and it was so terrifying to me. I was so intimidated. And his kid was such a difficult kid. I mean, I don't want to call him a jerk because he really was a sweet kid, but oh. And I realized for that experience that, you know what? Ambassadors are people. They got kids too, and their kids aren't always perfect. So it was.
Well, I would like to remind you that we are speaking with Eileen and Bruce Williams here on Talking Story, and you are listening to Coast Community Radio. So you touched on something that I would that I would really like to address, and let's see, I can't decide where we should go first, but as teachers abroad, did you notice a reverence for your profession that you never noticed anywhere else?
Yes.
Very, very much so. Yeah.
Just yes. When I was in Burma and we were leaving after 5 years of living in the country, I had two Burmese sixth graders that I had taught all year long that came up to me and said, Mrs. Williams, may we show you our appreciation in the Burmese way? So I said, okay. And they kneeled down on the ground and touched their head to my feet three times and said, thank you for being our teacher.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. And the kids were always appreciative. Well, you know, they were kids. They weren't always perfect by any stretch, but the fight for homework wasn't that much of a fight. You know, you always had that, but it wasn't bad. And the parents always were respectful and kind. Oh, except for one parent in Burma who was, oh, so demanding and awful. But most of them were just really wonderful.
Was this perhaps a tiger mom? Is that what they are called?
It was a tiger dad.
Oh,
and,
okay.
He was pretty vicious, but oh well. Those exist around the world.
Yes.
Well, we raised our children from in their elementary years in Burma. That was, you know, I think we left when my daughter was in eighth grade and my son was in fifth grade. And we only left because we had a plan to see the world, and living in Burma forever was not really part of the plan. But we could have stayed for a long, long time. I encourage anyone that can go and visit that country to do it. It's an amazing, amazingly beautiful spiritual place to go.
It was probably our favorite country to visit. Whenever we, you know, people often ask, what was your favorite place? Of course. And, you know, Burma is used to be an automatic answer with a straightforward yes. And I'll tell you why. The people are so genuinely wonderful. It was a country that I found really lived their religion. In Burma, they're Buddhists, of course. And they honestly lived their religion outside in every aspect. It was amazing to see. And then lately, with the problems with the Rohingya being so heavily persecuted, you have to rethink through that. And I wonder if maybe that behavior was because they themselves were so heavily repressed, mm-hmm. that was their way of handling that pressure and turning to religion to comfort themselves. And when the country loosened up a little bit, they began to behave badly towards those people that they said were other, different.
It's very sad. No matter how you look at it, it's, to me, it's incomprehensible. It just does not go along with Buddhist thought to persecute a minority that way. But anyway, we decided we needed to do something different after our two Asia experiences, and we moved to Nairobi, Kenya.
Nairobi, Kenya. Wow.
Yes, do tell.
Lions and, well, not tigers and bears. Can't say that because they don't live in Africa. But
probably a giraffe, a rhino or two.
A few antelope and, you know, elephants all over the place. Well, they weren't quite all over the place, but boy, it was right next door. As you drove into town from the airport, you went through downtown on the main street. They had these big trees arching over the street. And nesting or standing in these trees are these gigantic red and white vultures that are just magnificent looking at first until you get close enough to see them, and then they're kind of scary.
We actually saw a giraffe on our way in our first day.
Yeah.
So Kenya is a fascinating place. You have all the trips, the safaris, where you get to see animals in all kinds of close-up settings, and we've even camped in places surrounded by thorn bushes so the elephants wouldn't trample us, and oh my goodness, we did a lot of exciting things. But Kenya is also an adolescent country. It got its independence from Great Britain in the 60s. And it's still finding itself. There's a huge amount of corruption in the government, a huge amount of tribalism, distrust amongst different tribes. They have different languages, different customs.
Do you find that those kind of seat nicely on top of each other, that kind of cultural, almost feudalism is reflected in the corruption in the government?
Oh yes. An election is a violent emotional experience in Kenya, because if your tribe, someone from your tribe gets elected, you're going to get the roads, you're going to get the electricity, you're going to get the hospitals. And so it's a fight for survival. And the elections are pretty scary times.
Yeah, we actually were driving home from a vacation, and turned out that it was election night. And it was in the evening, dark. We were maybe an hour and a half from our house, and we were going through small towns. And in every town we went through, the people were out in the street in large numbers, and they were emotional to the point of jeering happiness, extreme anger. There were people pounding on our car, wanted to stop us and talk to us about the election. And I just kept driving slowly forward and did not stop, because I was terrified to stop.
Wow.
And
the
we got
tension
home.
Was definitely palpable, it sounds
absolutely.
Like.
Absolutely. Politics there was something else. But, you know, I mean, God, it's so amazing, you know, to these countries. You can divide them so well into this turbulent governmental attempt to make things work, and the absolute incredibleness of the wildlife in Africa, of the tribes getting to know the people and how they live, and like all the other countries, I guess, that we've lived in, we found the people that were so generous and so warm and welcoming and interested in us just as much as we were in them.
I'd like to say something about citizenship of the world.
Oh, excellent, because I have one I think, very important final question that I'd like to interject when you're done.
Okay. The thing, we were in Kenya, for example, when 9/11 happened. I had students from Somalia, from Sudan, from Afghanistan, from all different parts of the world in my class. And they looked at us like, why? It's a horrible thing that happened in your country, but these horrible things are happening in my country every single day, and nobody is having 10 minutes of silence and vigils and the kinds of things we were doing for 9/11. And that's just one example, but you begin to realize just how many cultures and countries and points of view there are. And it's very, very difficult to come back and just see things from one point of view in the United States.
Yes. Wow.
So I encourage all of you to get out there and travel. Honestly, opens up your eyes to the world and opens your mind.
And breaks down borders and stereotypes and that single story complex. That people, if you only know one thing about a country, you don't know much.
I always like to say it's really great to go and find out that there are many different ways to solve the problems of living that work really well, not just our way. So it's pretty cool.
And in these last few minutes, I would love for you guys to reflect on how you see that in your kids and this brilliant experience that you gave them as parents.
Our kids are citizens of the world. They really, really are. They have, of course, friends from all over the world, but my daughter majored in languages in school and is fluent in French and Spanish and, of course, her native English. She went back to Kenya and worked for 6 months during her medical residency. She loves to travel. And my son, same thing. He is so open to other cultures and ideas and also fluent in Spanish. And he travels. He actually works with Amazon, but they send him to Romania and to India. And he has a degree in international
relations.
Oh, wonderful.
If I can add to that this time. Just that, you were asking how we see the life overseas reflected in our kids. You know, of course, I think they turned out great, but I can tell you some of the influences that were just intense in that. You know, and I think the main was that in their schools, not just their peer group, but the entire school, if you wanted to be socially cool, you had to try to do well in school. You didn't have to be a top student. That wasn't an issue, but you had to try. And they grew up with that culture. So to them, it was natural to look around and say, okay, let's look at this and learn about it and get to work on it. No problem. That's one of the best things, you know, plus that international culture. They have, you know, Facebook. Oh my gosh. They have dozens of their friends from around the world that they are constantly in contact with these days. It's astonishing. And we do too. It's really a small world.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for coming in today and talking about your fabulous experiences. I really appreciate it. We've been talking with Eileen and Bruce Williams about living abroad and their very fabulous experiences here on Talking Story on Your Coast Community Radio. Thanks.
Thanks an awful lot, Lynn.